This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. Cast your mind back to January. A video of two Menindee residents goes viral. In the video, both men, Dick Arnold and Rob McBride, are standing on the banks of the Lower Darling River in New South Wales, surrounded by hundreds of dead fish. And they're both holding large dead Murray cod.
My name is Dick Arnold. I'm here with Rob McBride for this really sad bloody shot here, caused by the government, environmental disaster. And look at these iconic fish of Australia being treated like this. You have to be bloody disgusted with yourself. You politicians and cotton grower manipulators. That's bloody atrocious.
This is nothing to do with drought. This is a man-made disaster brought to you by the New South Wales government, the federal government and the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. This is the result of draining the Menindee Lakes twice in 4 years and killing the system. This fish is 100 years old. It's never coming back. This is bloody disgraceful.
Welcome to part two of our summer series on climate change and weather. Over six episodes, environment editor Peter Hannam and I will discuss global warming, water, the weather, bushfires, the energy grid, and how we're going to get through this already unprecedented summer. Joining us this week is Mike Foley from our Federal Politics Bureau to discuss the Murray-Darling Basin and its future. So what is the situation now in the Murray-Darling, and how did it get so bad? Welcome Peter Hannam and Mike Foley. I just want to introduce Mike to our listeners, probably for the first time. Mike joined us in our Canberra Bureau just a couple of months ago as our new climate and energy reporter. But until he joined us, he was most recently working for Australian Community Media covering water and the Murray-Darling. So what Mike doesn't know about the Murray-Darling probably isn't worth knowing. No pressure, Mike. Can you please start by giving us an overview of the water situation in Australia as it stands? How long have we been in drought and how bad is it?
It's bad. It's the Bureau of Meteorology and the Murray-Darling Basin Authority who oversee management of the river system, class it as one of the worst on record. You know, scientists, they always hedge their bets, but one of the worst on record. There's a critical level rating in many river systems that comprise the Murray-Darling Basin. Critical means that there's water managers who distribute flows along the river out of dams manage with the priority of critical human need first and foremost. It means there's not enough to go around, basically. And to boil it all down and be very short and sharp, the north of the basin, so draw a line from Dubbo West in New South Wales, above that, to the north of that, it's really dry. There haven't been significant inflows for more than 3 years. It's the driest on record. And in the south, it's as dry in the southern Murray-Darling Basin as well. So that's south of Dubbo. You think towns of Wagga, Goulburn-Murray system, Albury, all that stuff there. Still got some water in the major dams, though, from previous wetter seasons before the drought kicked off. But the inflows are record low.
Across the Murray-Darling Basin, the last 33 months have been the driest on record. Water storages for the entire basin have dipped below 40%, with some northern storages as low as 1%, devastating communities and the environment.
So, is there any reason at all to be optimistic about sometime in the next 12 months, this drought breaking?
The short-term outlook over summer is not good. And perhaps Peter could speak to this as well, but we're hanging out for the winter rains to come and replenish in the north and the south. Winter rainfall is less likely in the north, the way the prevailing weather patterns go. There's some summer rain that comes down from Queensland and monsoons, but it's all hinging on winter rainfall. Is that right, Peter?
Yes. So basically, unless you get a decent cyclone remnant passing, later in the summer, you might get some rain in the northern basin. But the general outlook is below average rainfall into March and beyond. I think that's the current Bureau forecast. And the way they put it is that with soil moisture levels so low that you really need some wet periods to replenish what's really a very poor state.
So we have seen a lot of coverage of what impact this lack of rainfall is having on agriculture and on farmers and on the stock that they've had to try and get through this drought. What we haven't heard so much about in the city is the impact on the country towns. Peter, are there towns that are approaching literally having no water when you turn on the tap?
Yes, so you've got a few smaller villages getting trucked in water across the northern parts of the Murray-Darling Basin. Lately, and just to take it briefly outside the basin, we're now seeing coastal, for instance, New South Wales towns running out of water. Some of these towns were relying on rivers for all their water. They don't have dams, like Bellingen, for example. So when there's nothing coming from upstream, brackish water comes in with the tide, they're starting to struggle. And so there's a range of bores, pipes, you name it, efforts going on to try to get water to some of these towns which are currently, you know, facing severe shortages in the very near term. None of the big towns yet are getting trucked in water, but you can take a town like Cobar, for example, which has mines nearby, and that's relying on water effectively coming from Burrendong Dam, and that's now at like 2.8% full and not looking like going to have much more water in that area soon.
And as far as water supply for Sydney, is there any danger to the catchment because of the current bushfire crisis?
This is a really interesting and very topical issue. Around Lake Burragurang, which is behind Warragamba Dam, you've got 80% of Sydney's water supply. That dam's about 45% full and falling at about 1% or half a percentage point per week at the moment. But the big problem they've got is nearly the whole area around there has been burnt in the recent fires. Those fires aren't out, so there's a reasonable expectation that the parts that haven't been burnt, you know, may have that area scorched before long. The issue for Sydney is if you get a major rain event, and it's not guaranteed that we're going to get one, but if you were to get one with so much ash lying around, you know, on the floor, that'll be potentially washed into the dam. And that creates a whole series of treatment issues, particularly if algal blooms start to break out. It's a major concern, which I think is only just getting some of the attention it deserves.
So while everyone's praying for rain, we don't want too much of it at once.
No, exactly. In fact, the only rain this time of year that tends to arrive over those areas, the catchment, is typically thunderstorms. If you get a big one in the wrong place, you could have, I'm told, anything more than about 20 millimetres in a short spell would be enough to wash a lot of the ash into the dam and then into the reservoir. So we'd have to hope that the treatment works and so on are gearing up for some extra work to get the water to the city.
So, Mike, there's a lot of people whose job it is to worry about the water system and to manage it. Can you please give us an overview of what the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, what its purpose is and how it's administered?
I think to kick off a general discussion for our listeners that might not be overly familiar with what the Basin Plan is, I'd like to set out a modest goal. We can talk about lots of interesting stuff and insights, but if you leave this podcast with an understanding of a universal truth in water management, I haven't done my job. It's a dog's breakfast. It really is, and water managers will tell you that. The Inspector General, Mick Kelty, who's come from the AFP, will tell you that. It's confusing. But what the Murray-Darling Basin Plan is, to answer your question, in 2013, the then Labor government legislated it, and it gives the Commonwealth government powers to go and buy water rights back from irrigators in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, and South Australia. And the purpose that they're buying those water rights back is to give them to a Commonwealth authority, which is called the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder, or if you want to sound like you're an insider, they're known as the CHU. And the CHU is an irrigator for the environment. They literally deploy water down the river from the dams. And what that means is they tell the person that opens the dam gate in Hume, Dartmouth, or the small dams up in the northern basin as well, like Pindari or Split Rock, tell them when to open the dam wall, for how long. And if you're a river management boffin, you can sort of predict how fast the water flows and where it's going to get into. And by that, that means get up over a bank and flood a forest. It might mean get into a weir pool and flush out stagnant water with some fresh water. It might mean move past a particular point in the river that you know will stimulate the native fish to breed. It's because some native fish need a certain type of flow rate to start breeding at a certain time. For example, Murray cod like to breed when the Melbourne Cup kicks off. So that's what the Basin Plan is, basically, in a nutshell. It's way, 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 way more complicated than that, but that sort of gives you a flavour of what it was set up to do.
You're listening to Please Explain. We'll be right back after this.
From the team that brought you Phoebe's Fall and Wrong Skin comes a new 10-part investigative podcast.
Motor vessel Pong Su, I intend to board you.
I thought to myself, this is this boat.
The Last Voyage of the Pong Su is a story of drugs, cops, espionage, military, death, a dictator, and mateship.
Flag of my honor is Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
150 kilos of heroin had never been imported before.
These people, they expected to be executed.
It's a dead person.
Holy shit.
Search for The Last Voyage of the Pong Su on your favourite podcast app.
Is it really as complicated between the states as we all like to think it is? I mean, I've had people tell me recently, people say, you know, you drive across the border between New South Wales and Victoria and Victoria's all green and verdant because they're getting all the water. Is that true?
No. I won't be popular for saying that either, but states have a huge say in how the water is managed, even under the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. The Basin Plan controls environmental stuff, and then the employees in the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, which was set up to implement the plan and sort of do the research and all that stuff, they help advise on when the river should flow to maximise benefits for the environment. And you got to time it in with water releases for irrigators who typically like to get their water out at the start of summer. So you're sort of getting an idea of the complexity. And within that, sitting beside that, and just as importantly, there are things called water sharing plans. They're management regimes for who gets how much water and when in each valley. So you've got the Lachlan Valley, the Murrumbidgee, the Goulburn, all across the basin, and they're their own discrete little systems that make up a big part of the whole. States manage them, holus bolus, and every state has their own version of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, their own water departments. And then, Tori, beside that, let's just get even more complicated. There's a massive piece of legislation that was set up at Federation, the Water Act, that locks in rock-solid constitutional agreement between all the states on how the water is shared from the Murray to all New South Wales, Vic and Queensland and South Australia, of course, at the end of the system. And it guarantees a certain volume into South Australia. So, and that's outside the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, and so are the state water sharing plans. They all have to somehow come together and be managed by people to maximise the benefits to the environment and to the people who the government actively encourages to buy water rights. They're the irrigators, to maximise the value of this shared resource. It's not handed out as a charity or as a business mechanism. It's a financial arrangement. And then just to round off, on top of that, there's another layer of enormous complexity that Australia has gone out ahead of every other country with this free market water reform that kicked off in 1994 and is separated ownership of land and water rights, which is a whole podcast in itself. And now you can trade water up and down the basin, and it brings in corporates. It brings in ideas of family farms getting shut out of the market by big players who have big books that can vest over long term. But then again, in 1994, the government's reacted to pressure from, well, public pressure and also from environment groups to look at how traditional farms were using water. And the question was openly asked in the public debate then, is this precious shared resource going to generating maximum value for the taxpayer and for the Commonwealth? And the answer was no, that obviously, because we came up with a huge reform that was very controversial. That's only scratching the surface.
So, Peter, can I put to you, it's not surprising that this is so political because there's nothing more important to our survival than water. How much of the outcomes of what happens in the river, for instance, the big fish kills that happened at Menindee last summer that we'll be very much hoping won't be replicated this summer, how much of that is to do with management or mismanagement or just natural factors that are outside our control?
Well, look, I'd probably say that, I mean, the government's own agencies have said that the mismanagement of, for instance, New South Wales water brought forward the drought by about 3 years for instance, the Menindee areas where they had those fish kills. And the particular event that kind of set this off, I'd say, was when Kevin Humphreys, the water minister for New South Wales, in I think 2013, changed the water sharing plan for New South Wales in a way that actually excluded the worst drought as a baseline. They counted that as an anomaly. So he sort of reset what was kind of considered available water. And in the years since, of course, the over-extraction upstream in the Barwon Darling has probably got worse. And that's, you know, where we saw the fish kills through the Darling River.
It's the 7th of January, 2019, in the Menindee Weir Pool, just at the boat ramp. You can see the ramp there in the background. Quite a few of these are dead from yesterday, but this is a lot more. There's been a stacked eye overnight. Still looks like they're dying further downstream. Dead carp, again. No yellows at this stage this morning, perch, no cod.
I think probably the remaining issues, which we'll see in this summer, will be probably in other basins, perhaps Murrumbidgee and so on, where the water flows are becoming limited, that, you know, you'll see fish kills, for instance, in those areas. The big issue, though, I think, has been the massive expansion of the nuts, walnuts, almonds, etc., those plantings, which have really changed the nature of water demand, because these are perennial crops. They need 5 years, basically, or several years at least, to before they can produce anything to get full growth. Unlike rice, cotton, your annual crops, which, you know, you can just stop, and fodder. So nuts, they've got to be watered. And a study for the Victorian government in the middle of this year found that it's potential that the nuts that are coming into by 2025, the ones that are planted, may only themselves be able to get 40% of the water needs. And this is when they basically outbid everything else. So not only are they pushing out dairy, because of fodder can't compete, cotton, you know, the grapes, etc., but they are actually probably cannibalizing their own resource. So we might find that we've planted all these trees for years and then not have the availability. And I'm told that we could start to see that even this summer in some places.
And on that point, Tori, I'd just like to pick up and clarify what Peter said. I agree with, actually, but to take it further, it can be so easy to misunderstand. There is huge demand of nuts sucking up all the water that's available to them, and it's able to become available through them through the trading system. But the existence of nuts, the vast majority are down in the Sunraysia, Lower Murray area, which is interesting in itself. They went there because the land was so cheap and there were no planning restrictions by the local councils down there in Vic and New South Wales and in SA. But they're not going to take any extra water out of the system. And that's the important thing to note. So their impact, there's an overall cap on, like, valley by valley, and overall it's set. You know, it's a set volume. The annual extraction limit is 10,500 gigalitres if you're keeping score at home. So what it is, as Peter said, is their nuts are driving up the price of water, and they're competing with traditional industries. And the interesting thing about the competition with traditional industries is they're all located in the sweet spot in New South Wales and Victoria, up near to the dams that were built at the same time as the Snowy scheme, because there's good soil and you don't have to shunt the water too far down the river to get to them, so you don't lose the water in creeks and soils and wetlands and that sort of, so it's really efficient. But when you have thousands of kilometres away down past, way past Swan Hill in Robinvale, demanding water, you lose a massive whack of it as it travels down the river system, so that's really inefficient. And as Peter said, rice, dairy, the new entrants, cotton, grapes, all the nice stone fruits that we like to see that are irrigated are finding it hard to compete with the price. And it's a huge unknown. That's the honest thing to say. We don't know how this is going to end.
So none of this is going to be solved simply by it raining. While we do have to wrap up this episode of Please Explain, we will come back and reconvene. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks so much to our Please Explain guests this week, Environment Editor Peter Hannam and Climate and Energy Reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, Mike Foley, from our Federal Politics Bureau. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe, the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. We're taking a short break from our climate series over Christmas, but Peter and I will be back on January 9. This episode was produced and edited by Leah Samoglu. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.